Disc 4.
Bev dips into her beach bag for a single key attached to a small fishing bobber, in case she ever accidentally drops the key into the water. Her attention wanders around the crowded parking lot, fixing on the Cherokee. I guess I'd better crank her up to make sure the battery ain't dead.
Well, if it is, Jack says, lining up the four gas cans near the pump, you know I'll jump her.
Bev watches him squat, sticking the gas nozzle into each can, the pump clicking away her cash. The back of his neck reminds her of alligator hide, and his elbows are big calluses. She's been coming to him at least 10 times a year, more often of late, and he doesn't have a damn clue about her, which is a good thing for him. She heads to the SUV, suddenly worried about whether it needs gas, too. She can't remember if she filled it up last time. Unlocking the driver's door, she slides in and turns the key in the ignition. The engine cranks after 3 tries, and she's relieved to see she has more than half a tank of gas. When she runs low, she'll fill up at a gas station. Turning the headlights on, she backs up and parks near the dock. While she is pulling cash out of her wallet and squinting to make out the bills, Jack wipes his hands on a rag and waits for her to roll down the window.
"That'll be $44.40, he tells her. "I'll get those cans back in your boat for you and keep an eye on it. I noticed you got your friend with you."
He means the shotgun.
"You plan on leaving it in the boat? I wouldn't. Watch out shooting at gators with that thing. All it does is make 'em rageful."
Bev can't believe she almost drove off and left her shotgun. She's not thinking clearly tonight, and her knee hurts.
"Last thing you do before you leave," she adds as he steps down into the boat, "is fill the fish box with ice."
"How much?"
He fetches the shotgun, climbs back up on the dock, and carefully places it on the back seat of the Cherokee.
£100 will do.
"Must be doing a lot of shopping to need all that ice."
He stuffs the rag in a back pocket of his old soiled work pants.
"Stuff spoils quick out here."
"That'll be another 20. I'm giving you $3 off."
She hands him 2 tens and doesn't thank him for the discount.
"I'm gone by 9.
He looks past her into the beat-up Cherokee.
"So if you ain't back by then..."
"Won't be,"
Bev tells him, shifting the SUV into reverse. She never is, and doesn't need the reminder. He stares past her at the front passenger's door, at the rolled-up window, and the missing crank and push-in lock.
"You know, girl, I could fix that if you're ever of a mind to leave the keys."
Bev glances at the door.
"Don't matter," she says. "Nobody rides in this thing but me."
29. Upstairs in the north wing of the house is a guest bedroom overlooking the ocean, and in front of the bay window is Scarpetta's large desk. Not an antique or anything special, just an inexpensive computer desk with a matching return. Bookcases fill the walls so tightly that some light switches and electrical receptacles are behind them, out of reach, and she has to get by with power strips. Her furniture is a light manure vapal, in depressing contrast to the beautiful antiques and artistic pieces, including oriental rugs, fine stemware, and china that she spent most of her career collecting. Scarpetta's former life is locked up in a Connecticut storage warehouse, one secure enough for museum pieces. She has not gone to see what she owns since Lucy took care of her aunt's chattel more than 2 years ago, choosing the location because of its proximity to New York, where Lucy has her headquarters and apartment. Scarpetta doesn't miss the furniture from her past. It is useless to care about it. Just the thought of it makes her tired for reasons she doesn't completely comprehend. The office in her Del Rey rental house is a comfortable size, although nowhere near as spacious and organized as what she was accustomed to in her Richmond house, where she had cabinets of hanging files, miles of workspace, and a massive desk custom-built of Brazilian cherry. Her house there was modern Italian country, put together stone by stone, the walls antiqued plaster, the exposed beams 19th-century Black Jarrah railroad ties from South Africa. If the house she built in Richmond wasn't beautiful before, it was spectacular by the time she remodeled it in an attempt to eradicate the past, a past haunted by Benton and Jean-Baptiste Chandon. But she felt no better.
The ghosts followed her from room to room. Her denial of unbearable loss and her own near murder were fragmented dreams of horror that chilled her no matter the temperature inside the house. Every creak of old wood and utterance of wind sent her hand reaching for the pistol she carried as her heart beat hard. One day she walked out of her magnificent home and never went back, not even to retrieve her belongings. Lucy handled that. For one who had always walled her soul from a wicked world and unreachable pain, she found herself a wanderer, skipping from one hotel to another like a stone across water, making phone calls to set up private consulting, and quickly became so bound in the snarled chains of evidence, of investigative incompetence and carelessness of police and medical examiners all over the place, that she had no choice but to settle in another house, because she had to settle somewhere. She could no longer review cases while sitting on a hotel bed. "Go south, far south," Lucy told her quietly, lovingly, one afternoon in Greenwich, Connecticut, where Scarpetta was in hiding at the Homestead Inn. "You aren't ready for New York yet, Aunt Kay, and you sure as hell aren't ready to work for me." "I'll never work for you," Scarpetta meant it, shame pulling her eyes away from her niece.
"Well, you don't have to be insulting about it."
Lucy was stung, too, and within a minute the two of them were arguing and fighting.
"I raised you," Scarpetta blurted out from the bed where she sat, rigidly and enraged. "My goddamn sister, the admired author of children's books, who doesn't have a clue about raising her own goddamn child, dumped me on your doorstep. I mean, the other way around."
"Freudian slip? You needed me worse than I needed you."
"Not hardly. You were a monster. At 10, when you rolled into my life like the Trojan horse, I was stupid enough to let you park. And then what? Then what?"
The great chief, the logical doctor lawyer, was sputtering, tears rolling down her face.
"You had to be a genius, didn't you? The worst brat on earth."
Scarpetta's voice quavered.
"And I couldn't give you up, you awful child."
She could hardly speak.
"If Dorothy had wanted you back, I would have taken the bitch to court and proved she wasn't a fit mother."
"She wasn't a fit mother, and she isn't."
Lucy was beginning to cry, too.
"A bitch? That's charging her with a misdemeanor when she's a felony. A felony. A character disorder. For God's sake, how did you end up with a psycho for a sister?"
Lucy weeps, sitting next to her aunt on the bed, their shoulders touching.
"She's the dragon you always fight. Have spent your life fighting," Scarpetta said.
"You're really fighting, Mom. She's too small a quarry for me. She's nothing more than a rabbit with sharp teeth that goes after your ankles. I don't waste my time on rabbits. I don't have time."
"Please go south," Lucy begged her, getting up from the bed and facing her with wet eyes and a red nose. "For now, please. Go back to where you came from and start all over."
"I'm too old to start over."
"Shit," Lucy laughed. "You're only 46, and men and women stare at you everywhere you go, and you don't even notice. You're one hell of a package."
The only time Scarpetta was ever called a package was when she was in worse trouble than usual and required off-duty police for security. On their radios, they referred to her as the package. Scarpetta wasn't entirely sure what they meant.
She moved south to Delray Beach, not exactly returning to her roots, but to an area near where her mother and sister live, yet safely far away.
Inside her weather-beaten 1950s rented house, her office is piled with paperwork and stiff cardboard slide folders, so much of it stacked on the floor that she has to make an effort not to trip over her work, making it impossible for her to be her usual prepossessed self when she walks in. Bookcases are crammed. Some medical and legal tomes are double-shelved, while her rare antique books are protected from the sun and humidity in a tiny room next door that was probably intended to be the nursery.
She picks at Rose's fresh tuna salad as she goes through her mail, her letter opener a scalpel.
She slices open the manila envelope first, apparently from her niece or perhaps someone else in her office, and is baffled to discover another envelope inside, this one plain white, and addressed by hand in calligraphy to Madame K. Scarpetta, LLB. She drops the manila envelope on the table and hurries out of her office, rushing past Rose without speaking,
and into the kitchen for freezer paper. 30. Taxicabs remind Benton of insects. And during his exile, he has grown fond of certain insects. Stick bugs look remarkably like twigs. Benton often loses himself in parks and along sidewalks, patiently searching shrubbery for a stick bug, or better yet, a praying mantis, which is extremely rare and a good omen, although he has never experienced a positive change in fortune directly after spotting a praying mantis. Maybe someday he will. Ladybugs are good luck. Everybody knows that. If one ends up wherever he is staying, he gently coaxes it onto his finger and takes it outside, no matter how many flights of stairs, and deposits it on a bush. 1 week he did this 10 times, and enjoyed the thought that it was the same ladybug flirting with him. He believes that all kindnesses will be repaid. He also believes that evil will get its ugly reward, and until he began his non-existence he argued about that with Scarpetta often, because he didn't believe it at all back then, and she did. We often don't know the reason for things, Benton, but I believe there is one always. He hears Scarpetta's voice in a remote cavern of his brain as he sits in the dark back seat of a southbound taxi. How can you say that? He hears his own voice answering her. Because I've seen enough to say it. What reason can there possibly be for a sister or a daughter or a brother or a son or a parent or a significant other to be raped, tortured, and murdered? Silence. The taxi driver is listening to hip-hop. Turn that down, please, Benton calmly says, this time out loud. Or what about the old woman struck by lightning because her umbrella frame was metal? Scarpetta doesn't answer him. Okay, then what about the entire family killed by carbon monoxide because no one told them not to cook with charcoal in the fireplace, especially with the windows closed? What reason, Kay? His sense of her continues to linger like her favorite perfume. So there's a reason I was murdered and am gone from your life forever? The conversation has turned one-sided and won't stop. What reason has she assigned to what she believes happened to him, he asks, convinced she has come up with a reason, certainly by now. You're rationalizing, Kay. You have forgotten our talks about denial. Benton's facile mind moves on to another point as he rides in the taxi shortly after dark, en route to Manhattan, the trunk and every other space in the car piled with his belongings. The driver did not disguise his disgust when he realized that his fare came with a substantial pile of baggage. But Benton was clever. He hailed the cab from the street, and the driver didn't see the pile of luggage in the thick shadows of the sidewalk until he was faced with the choice of speeding off or accepting the lucrative job of driving a fare to New York. The driver's name is Robert Leary, a white male with brown hair, brown eyes, approximately 5'10" and 180 pounds. Those details and others, including the identification number on the photo ID clamped to the visor, are written in a refillable wallet-size leather notebook that Benton carries wherever he goes. As soon as he gets to his hotel room, he will, as is customary for him, transfer the notes to his laptop computer. Since he entered the Witness Protection Program, Benton has recorded his every activity, his every location, and every person he has met, especially if it is more than once, and even the weather and where he worked out and what he ate. Several times now, Robert Leary has attempted to initiate a conversation, but Benton stares out the window and says nothing. The driver, of course, having no idea that the man with the tan, chiseled, bearded face and shaved head is silently making points and examining tactical requirements and possibilities and probabilities from every tilt imaginable. No doubt the cabbie is thinking it is his sorry luck to have picked up a weirdo who, based on the shabbiness of his luggage, has fallen on hard times, very hard times. "You sure you can pay the fare?" he asks, or rather demands, for the third time. "It ain't gonna be cheap, you know, depending on what route I end up taking, depending on traffic and what streets they got closed off in the city. These days you never know what streets the cops will close off. Security. It's something. Me, I'm not a big fan of machine guns and guys in camouflage." "I can pay the fare," Benton replies. The headlights of passing cars slash his window, briefly lighting up his somber face. Of this he is certain. Jean-Baptiste Chandon's attempted murder of Scarpetta has no point or meaning beyond the remarkable fact that she used her wits and survived. Thank God. Thank God. Other schemes to bring about her ruination have no meaning beyond the miracle that they, too, have failed. Benton is well versed in the details, perhaps not all of them, but what he has followed in the news is enough. Every person involved in his plan is tangentially, if not directly, connected to the Chandon's evil, intricate network. Benton knows what empowers the Chandons and what robs them of their strength. He knows the receptacles, without whom the major conduits between drones and the higher order cannot function. The solution to the situation has always been far too complicated for anyone to work out, but for 6 years Benton has had nothing to do but work it out. The answer, he discovered, is simple. Surgically snip and strip the wires and disconnect, then splice, rewire, and reconnect so that the criminals short circuit and the Chandon Empire implodes. Meanwhile, Benton, the dead Benton, invisibly watches what he has designed and implemented as if it is a video game, and no player in his game has an inkling about what is going on, except that something is, and whatever it is must be instigated by traitors from inside. Main players must die. Other players, many of whom Benton does not know, will be blamed and labeled traitors. They will die. By this method, Benton will manipulate his enemies and delete them one by one. By his calculations, the coalition comprised of himself and others who do not even know they have been conscripted into his private army will complete his mission in a few months, perhaps weeks. By his calculations, Rocco Caggiano is already dead, or soon will be dead, killed in cold blood, his murder staged, and Lucy and Rudy may know what they are doing or have done, but what they don't know is the video game. They don't know that they are in it. What Benton did not calculate, and would never have anticipated, is that Kay Scarpetta would form a connection to Baton Rouge, the most strategic position on Benton's mental map. For some reason, this part of his near-perfect plan has failed. He doesn't know why. He doesn't know what happened. He reviews every detail repeatedly, but at the end of the routine the screen is blank, a useless cursor blinking hypnotically at him. Now Benton must rush. It is against his nature to rush. Scarpetta was never supposed to have any contact whatsoever with anything or anybody in Baton Rouge. Marino was. The last precinct was. Learning that his son is dead would inevitably result in Marino's retracing Rocco's steps, which would lead Marino and his compatriots to Baton Rouge, where Rocco keeps an apartment and has for many years. The port in Baton Rouge is formidable. The Gulf Coast is gold. All manner of valuable and dangerous materials travels the Mississippi daily. Baton Rouge is yet another Chandon holding, and Rocco has enjoyed many successes and gratifications there, including sovereign immunity from the police, and intrigues, including protecting Jay Talley and Jean-Baptiste Chandon as they enjoyed their fair share of fun in the Baton Rouge area. Jean-Baptiste and Jay were only 16 the first time they visited Baton Rouge. Jean-Baptiste honed his murderous skills by killing prostitutes after Jay was serviced by them. Those cases have never been linked, because the former coroner abdicated his investigative rights to other agencies, and the police didn't give a damn about prostitutes. One step would lead to another until Marino discovered Jay Talley and Bev Kiffman in Baton Rouge and eliminated them. That was the plan. Scarpetta was never supposed to be part of it. His pulse beats rapidly in his temples. He holds his wrist close to his face, unable to read the time on his cheap black plastic watch because the dial isn't luminescent. By design, it isn't. He wants nothing that glows in the dark. "What time should we get there?" he asks in the same clipped tone. "I don't know exactly," his driver replies. "Depends if the traffic stays light like this. Maybe another two and a half hours. A car draws close to them from the rear, its high beams bouncing blinding white light off the taxi's rearview mirror. The driver curses as a black Porsche 911 passes, its receding red taillights reminding Benton of hell. 31.
Scarpetta stares at the unopened letter, the warm, damp air moving freely through her open door. Clouds are black flowers floating low on the horizon, and she senses that rain will come before dawn and she will wake up with all the windows fogged up, which is intolerable. No doubt the neighbors think she's obsessive and mad when they see her on her balcony with bath towels at 7 a.m., vigorously wiping condensation off the outside of the glass. Then, because of her forced and despicable bond with him, she imagines him inside his death row cell with no view, and her mission of scrubbing clean her dewy, opaque windows becomes all the more urgent. The unopened letter addressed to Madame Scarpetta, LLB, is centered on a square of clean white freezer paper. Female physicians in France are addressed as Madame. In America, referring to a female physician as anything but doctor is an insult. She is unpleasantly reminded of crafty defense attorneys addressing her in court as Mrs. Scarpetta instead of Dr. Scarpetta, thereby stripping her of her credentials and expertise, in hopes that the jurors and perhaps even the judge would not take her as seriously as they would a medicinae doctor whose specialty of pathology and subspecialty of forensic pathology required 6 additional years of training after medical school. While it is true that Scarpetta also has a law degree, virtually no one adds the abbreviation for Legum Baccalaureus after her surname, and for her to do so would be arrogant and misleading, because she does not practice law. The 3 years she spent in law school at Georgetown were for the purpose of facilitating her eventual career in legal medicine, and that was all. To add the abbreviation LLB after her name is mocking in its pretentiousness and condescension. Jean-Baptiste Chandon. She knows the letter is from him. For an instant she smells his horrible stench. An olfactory hallucination. The last time she had one was when she visited the Holocaust Museum and smelled death. "I've been in the yard with Billy. He's done his business and is very busy chasing lizards," Rose is saying. "Anything else I can do for you before I leave?"
"No, thank you, Rose."
A pause, then, "Well, did you like my tuna salad?"
"You could open your own restaurant," Scarpetta says.
She puts on a fresh pair of white cotton examination gloves and picks up the letter and the scalpel, working the tip of the triangular blade into a top corner of the envelope.
Stainless steel hisses through the cheap paper.
32. The chair Rocco sits on is a padded one. Maybe it was 3 or 4 surreal hours ago. He was in the same chair eating dinner when room service knocked on his door to bring him a bottle of champagne. A very nice Moët et Chandon, compliments of the management. Rocco, who is streetwise and chronically paranoid, was not the least bit suspicious. He is an important man who stays in the Radisson whenever he is in Szczecin. It is the only decent hotel in the city, and management routinely sends him gifts, including fine cognac and Cuban cigars, because he pays his bills in American cash instead of worthless zloty. His habit of feeling secure in this hotel is how the intruder with the Colt pistol got inside Rocco's deluxe room. It happened so fast he didn't have time to react to the tall waiter who wasn't wearing a uniform and shoved his way inside with an empty bottle of champagne on a service tray he obviously had picked up outside another guest's room. This asshole, whoever he is, grabbed Rocco that easily. Rocco pushes his plate as far away from him as possible. He worries that next he will vomit. He has soiled himself. The room smells so foul he cannot understand how his captor endures it, but the young, muscular man sitting on the bed doesn't seem to notice. He stares at Rocco, the stare of a man high on adrenaline and ready to kill. He will not allow Rocco to clean up. He won't allow Rocco to get out of the chair. He drops his cell phone on the bed after another brief conversation with someone and goes over to the tray with its empty champagne bottle. Rocco watches the man carefully wipe off the bottle with a napkin. Rocco tries to place him. Maybe he has seen him before. Or maybe the explanation is that he has that look, the look of a federal agent.
"Listen," Rocco says over the noise of the TV. "Just tell me who and why. Come on. You tell me who and why, maybe we can work something out you'll like better. You're an agent, aren't you? Some kind of agent. That don't mean we can't work something out.
He has said this at least 6 times since the agent walked in with the empty bottle on its tray, then slammed the door shut with a back kick and pulled his gun. Several times now he has opened and slammed the door shut. This makes Rocco increasingly nervous. Although he doesn't understand the agent's purpose, it has crossed his mind, even during previous stays, that the doors shut so loudly in this hotel that they sound like gunshots.
"Keep your voice down," the agent tells him.
He places the champagne bottle on Rocco's table.
"Pick it up."
The agent nods at it. Rocco stares at the bottle and swallows hard.
"Pick it up, Rocco." "So I'll ask you again. How come you know my name?" Rocco persists. "Come on. You know me, right? We can work things out. Pick up the bottle."
He does. The agent wants Rocco's fingerprints on the bottle. This is not good. The agent wants it to appear as though Rocco ordered or somehow acquired the champagne and drank it. This is very bad. His fears gather in strength as the agent returns to the bed, picks up a jacket, and pulls out a leather flask. He unscrews the cap and returns to Rocco's table, pouring a large amount of vodka in what is left of one of Rocco's cocktails.
"Drink up," the agent says.
Rocco swallows the vodka in several gulps, grateful as it burns its way down, warming him and sending its seductive, dulling agents along his blood and to his head. His confused thoughts float toward the hope that the agent is showing mercy, treating him decently, trying to make him relax. Maybe the agent's rethinking things, wants to make a deal. Rocco speculates, but it is a fact that someone sent the man. Someone who knows Rocco's business intimately and is aware that once a month he travels to Szczecin to handle Shandun affairs at the port. Rocco's primary responsibility is to deal with police and other officials. This is business as usual. He can do it drunk, nothing more than routine legal finagling and the usual fees, and, if necessary, reminders of what a dangerous world it is. Only an insider would know Rocco's schedule and where he stays. The hotel staff doesn't know what he does, only that he is from New York, or so he says. No one cares what he does. He is generous. He is rich. Instead of passing off the usual zloty, he pays and lavishly tips in American cash, which is very hard to come by and very useful on the black market. Everyone likes him. The bartenders double the Chopin vodka in his drinks at the upstairs bar, where he frequently sits in the dark, smoking cigars. His captor looks about 28, maybe early 30s. His black hair is short and styled with gel in that spiked look that a lot of young men like these days. Rocco notices the square jaw, straight nose, dark blue eyes, stubble, and the veins standing out in the man's biceps and hands. He probably doesn't need a weapon to crush someone. Women like him. They probably stare at him, hit on him. Rocco has never been attractive. As a teenager, he was already suffering from pattern baldness, and he couldn't stay away from pizza and beer and looked it. Envy possessed him. It always has. Women sleep with him only because he has power and money. Hatred toward his captor flares.
"You don't know what you're messing with here," Rocco says.
The agent doesn't bother answering him, his eyes darting around the room. Rocco wipes his face with his greasy napkin, his attention wandering to the steak knife on his plate.
"Try it," the agent says, looking at the steak knife. "Go ahead. Please try it. Make my life a hell of a lot easier." "I wasn't going to do nothing. Just let me go and we'll forget this ever happened." "I can't let you go. Truth is, this isn't my idea of fun. So I'm in a bad mood already. Don't piss me off. You want to help yourself? Well, you know what they say about coming clean at the end." "No. What the hell do they say? Where's Jay Talley and don't tell me another fucking lie, asshole?"
"I don't know," Rocco whines. "I swear to God I don't. I'm scared of him, too. He's crazy. He don't play the game, and every one of us stay clear of him. He marches to his own beat. Swear to God. Can I please change my pants? You can watch me. I won't try nothing."
Rudy gets off the bed and opens the closet door, the Colt casually by his side, indicating to an increasingly defeated and terrified Rocco that this man is not afraid of anything. There are maybe half a dozen flashy suits hanging on the rod,
and he pulls off a pair of pants and tosses them to Rocco. Go on. The agent opens the bathroom door and sits back down on the bed.
Rocco trembles as he walks inside the bathroom and peels off his pants and briefs. He tosses them into the tub, douses a towel with tap water, and wipes himself.
Jay Talley, the agent says again. Real name Jean-Paul Chandon. Ask me something else.
Rocco means it as he sits in a different chair.
Okay. We'll get back to Talley later. You got plans to take out your father?
The agent's stare is cold.
It's no secret you hate him. I don't claim him. Doesn't matter, Rocco. You ran away from home. You changed your name from Marino to Caggiano. What's the plan and who's involved?
Rocco hesitates for the longest time, thoughts jumping behind his bloodshot eyes. The agent gets up, breathing through his mouth as if to avoid the stench. He presses the barrel of the Colt against Rocco's right temple.
Who, what, when, and where, he says,
tapping the barrel of the pistol against Rocco's head with each word, don't fuck with me.
I was gonna do it. In a couple months, when he goes fishing. He always goes fishing at Bugs Lake the first week of August. Nail him in his cabin, make it look like a burglary gone bad. So you would kill your own father when he's on a fishing trip. You know what you are, Rocco? You're the worst shit I ever met.
33. Whenever Nick Robillard drives past the Snow Depot in downtown Zachary, she feels like crying. Tonight, the stand, with its hand-painted signs advertising snow cones, is dark and deserted. If Buddy were with her, he'd be staring out the window and begging, not caring that the Snow Depot is closed, and it isn't possible for his mother to buy him a treat. That boy loves snow cones more than anybody Nick's ever heard of, and despite her efforts to steer him away from sweets, he demands a snow cone, cherry or grape, every time she takes him anywhere in the car. Buddy is with his grandfather in Baton Rouge right now, where he always is when Nick has to work late, and ever since she returned from Knoxville, she works constantly. Scarpetta inspired her. The need to impress Scarpetta dominates Nick's life. She is determined to bring about the arrest of the serial killer. She is frantic about the abducted women, knowing it absolutely will happen again if the maniac isn't caught. She is tormented by grief and guilt because she is neglecting her son after she was away from him for 2.5 months. If Buddy ever stopped loving her or turned out wrong, Nick would want to die. Some nights, when she finally returns to her tiny Victorian house around the corner from St. John the Baptist Catholic Church on Lee Street, she lies in bed, staring at dark shapes inside her small room, and listens to the silence as she imagines Buddy sound asleep at her father's house in Baton Rouge. Thoughts about her son and ex-husband Ricky flit about like moths. She contemplates whether she would shoot herself in the heart or the head if she were to lose everything that matters. Not one person has any idea that Nick gets depressed. Not one person would ever imagine that there are times when she entertains thoughts of suicide. What keeps her from the unthinkable is her belief that self-murder is one of the most selfish sins a person can commit, and she envisions the dire consequences of such an act, pushing the fatal fantasy far out of reach until the next time she dives into a dead man's spin of powerlessness, loneliness, and despair. Shit, she whispers as she drives south on Main Street, leaving the Snow Depot behind in her emotional wake. I'm so sorry, buddy boy, my buddy boy. What a decision she faces, choosing between doing nothing about women being murdered and doing nothing about her son. 34. Mon petit trésor, agneau. My little treasured lamb, Scarpetta translates as her heart freezes at the sight of Chandon's handwriting, and she feels his presence in his letter to her. She has been sitting in the same position for so long, in the straight-backed wooden chair by her bedroom's open door, that her lower back aches, and the small glass table is sweating from the humid sea air. As she remembers to breathe, she realizes that every muscle is tense, her entire body like a clenched fist. The letter, the letter, the letter. It stuns her that his handwriting is beautiful, a practiced calligraphy penned in black ink, not a single word crossed through, not a single mistake that she can see at a glance. He must have spent a lot of time writing this letter to her, as if it was a loving endeavor, and the idea of that just adds to the horror. He thinks of her. He is telling her so by the very act of his artistic penmanship. She reads his words. "Do you know about the Red Stick yet, and that you must go there? But not until you come to see me first, in the Longhorn State, as they say. You see, I direct you. You have no will of your own. You may think you do, but I am the current running through your body, every impulse coming from me. I am inside you. Feel it. Do you remember that night? You eagerly opened your door and then attacked me because you could not face your longing for me. I have forgiven you for taking my eyes, but you could not take my soul. It follows you constantly. If you try, you can touch it. Maintenant, maintenant, it is time. The Red Stick awaits you. You must come to me first, or it will be too late to hear my stories. Only for you will I tell them. I know what you want, mon petit trésor agneau. I have what you want. In 2 weeks I will be dead and have nothing to say. Ha! Will you release me to the ecstasy, or will I release you, sinking my teeth into your soft, round loveliness? If you do not find me, I will find you. Love and rapture, Jean-Baptiste. In the old-style bathroom, with its plain white toilet, its plain plastic shower curtain around the plain white tub, its mildew-stained white walls, Scarpetta vomits. She drinks a glass of water from the tap and returns to the bedroom, to the table, to that blighted piece of paper, which she suspects will offer her no evidence. He is too clever to leave evidence. She sits in the chair, trying to fight the images of the filthy beast flying through her front door like an evil spirit crackling out of hell. Scarcely can she recall in detail the pursuit, that terrible pursuit around her living room, as he swung an iron hammer, the same iron hammer he had used before to shatter women's heads and bodies to battered flesh and splintered bone, especially their faces. At the time she was the medical examiner for the Richmond murders, it never occurred to her that she might be the next one. Since that near-death experience, she struggles to will away her imagined destruction of her own body and face. He would not have raped her. He isn't capable of rape. Jean-Baptiste's revenge on the world is to cause death and disfigurement to recreate others in his own image. He is the ultimate embodiment of self-hate. If it is true that she saved her life by permanently blinding him, then he should be so lucky as to be spared his own reflection in the polished metal mirror he must look at every day inside his death-row cell. Scarpetta goes to a hallway closet and moves the vacuum cleaner out of the way. She rolls out a suitcase. 35.
If you need anything, call me on my cell phone, Nick says, standing in the front doorway of her father's white brick house in the old garden district, where homes are large, and spreading canopies of magnolias and live oaks keep much of the city's old establishment in the shade. Even on the brightest days, Nick finds her childhood home dark and foreboding.
"Why, you know I'm not calling that new-fangled little phone of yours," her father says, winking at her. "Even if you don't make the call, you have to pay for it, isn't that right? Or does unlimited mileage, I mean minutes, apply?"
"What?" Nick frowns, then laughs. "Never mind. My new number's taped to the refrigerator, whether you decide to call it or not. If I don't call back right away, you know it's because I'm busy. Now you be good, buddy boy. You're my big man, right?"
Her 5-year-old son peeks out from behind his grandfather and makes a face.
"Got it."
Nick pretends to snatch his nose and tries the old trick of sticking her thumb up between two fingers.
"Do you want your nose back or not?"
Buddy looks like the proverbial toe-headed choir boy, dressed in overalls that are an inch too short. He touches his nose and sticks out his tongue.
"You keep sticking out that tongue of yours, and one day it won't fit in your mouth anymore," his grandfather warns him.
"Shh," Nick says. "Don't be saying things like that, Papa. He'll believe you."
She peeks around him and grabs her son.
"Gotcha."
She lifts him up and covers his face with kisses.
"Looks like it's time to go shopping, my big man. You're outgrowing your clothes again.
How come you keep doing that, huh?
I don't know.
He hugs her tightly around the neck.
Do you think it's possible you might wear something besides overalls?
She whispers in his ear. He vigorously shakes his head. She gently puts him down.
Why can't I come?
Buddy pouts.
Mama has to work. By the time you wake up, I'll be back, okay? You go on to bed like my big man, and I'll bring you a surprise.
What surprise?
If I told you, it wouldn't be a surprise, now would it?
Nick kisses the top of his head again, and he irritably musses his hair as if swatting away bugs.
Uh-oh, she says to her father. I believe someone's getting grumpy.
Buddy gives her a look, a mixture of anger and hurt that never fails to make Nick feel as though she has betrayed and failed him. Ever since her salesman ex-husband Ricky got the promotion he always wanted, he got more impossible to live with, traveling all the time, complaining and unkind. He's gone, and Nick's glad, relieved, but deeply wounded in ways she can't define. Hardships in life are always for the best if you do God's will, according to the doctrine of her father, who loves her but won't take her side in her failed marriage.
You ought to know that being a cop doesn't mix with holding on to a man if you ever get married,
he told her when she got accepted to the police academy 8 years ago, after a dreary career of working as a bookkeeper at the Ford dealership in Zachary, where she eventually met Ricky. They dated 3 months and moved in together. Another sin. At last she was free of her haunted house.
Mama had her own business,
Nick reminded her father every time he made his comments.
Honey, that's not the same. She didn't carry a gun.
Maybe if she had...
Now you hush your mouth.
She finished the sentence only once. This was after she filed for divorce, and her father berated her for an entire afternoon, pacing in his living room, his face a storm of disbelief, fear, and anger. He's a big, lanky man, and every upset stride seemed to carry him from one wall to the other, and jostled the antique crystal lamp on the table next to the couch, until it finally fell over and broke.
"Now look what you did!" he cried out. "You broke your mother's lamp!"
You broke it.
Girls don't need to be chasing criminals and shooting guns. That's why you lost Ricky. He married a pretty woman, not an Annie Oakley. And what kind of mother...
That was when Nick said it.
If Mama had a gun, maybe she wouldn't have been butchered by some fucking asshole right here in our own house.
Don't you dare use words like that,
he told her, emphasizing each stony word with a violent stab of his finger. Stabs that reminded her of what was done to her mother. They never touched the subject again. It remains a stalled storm front between them. No matter how often they see each other, she can't feel his warmth or get but so close. After 2 premature babies who didn't survive, Nick was born and is the only child her father has. After he retired from teaching high school sociology, he got bored and pretty much quit life. He spends his mornings working crossword puzzles when he's not babysitting and taking obsessively long, brisk walks. She knows he blames himself. Her mother was murdered 8 years ago in the middle of the day while he and Nick were both at work. Maybe she blames herself, too. Not so much for her mother's death, she tells herself, but because if Nick hadn't gone out with friends after work, her father might not have been the one to find his wife's body and blood all over the house from where she fought her killer running from room to room. By the time Nick got home, slightly drunk from beer, police were swarming the property, her mother's body already removed. Nick never saw it. It was a closed casket funeral. She's never been able to bring herself to get a copy of the police report, and because the case remains unsolved, the coroner's office won't give her a copy of the autopsy records. All she knows is that her mother was stabbed and slashed and bled to death. Knowing that was enough, but for some reason it isn't anymore. On this particular night, Nick is determined to talk, but that can't happen unless Buddy is occupied.
"You want to watch TV for a few minutes before bed?"
she asks him. It is a special privilege indeed.
"Yes,"
he says, still pouting. He runs inside the house, and the TV goes on. She nods at her father, and he accompanies her outside. "Come on," she whispers to him, and they pick their usual spot beneath the ancient live oak tree at the edge of the yard.
This had better be good.
He has his lines and never tires of reusing them. She catches the gleam of his teeth as he talks, and knows he's pleased when she drags him out in the middle of the night to have a secret conversation, one not meant for a toddler's ears.
I know you don't want to talk about it, Nick begins, but it's about Mama.
She feels him jerk and withdraw, as if his spirit has suddenly fled from his body.
I need to know more, Papa. Not knowing is doing something to me. Maybe because of what's happening around here now with these women disappearing. I'm feeling something. I don't know how else to say it, but I'm feeling something. Something terrible.
Her voice trembles.
And it's scaring me, Papa. The way I'm feeling sometimes is scaring me bad.
His silence is as formidable as the tree they stand under.
Remember when I got the ladder and propped it against this very tree?
She looks heavenward, her vision caught in thick, dark branches and leaves.
Next thing I know, I'm stuck up there, too scared to climb higher or come back down, and you had to get me.
I remember.
His voice sounds as if nobody is home.
Well, that's the way I feel right now, she goes on, trying to appeal to the part of him that shut down after his wife was murdered. I can't climb up or down, and I need you to help me, Papa.
There's nothing I can do, he says.
36. Szczecin's skyline is pierced by antennas, the streets quiet, the downtown shabby. Not one of the stores looks inviting, especially at this late hour, and the few cars out are old and worse for the wear. The Radisson is built of brick, the courtyard gray and red pavers, and a large blue banner out front welcomes a methods and models in automation and robotics meeting, and that is fortunate. The more people in the hotel, the better, and Lucy used to program robots and can talk technology with anybody if need be. But it won't be necessary. She has a plan, a very good one in all respects. She finds a spot to park several streets down from a Fila store just past a delicatessi. Flipping down the mirror on the visor, she quickly applies makeup and puts on gold hoop earrings. She yanks off her tennis shoes and pulls on sexy black satin cowboy boots that are disgustingly necessary, should someone spot her inside the hotel. She struggles into a black blouse, linen and wrinkled, and tucks her tactical baton up its sleeve. She unbuttons it low enough to show off cleavage. Transformed into a sexy young woman who is staying in the hotel, Lucy is sufficiently disheveled and alluring to pass for a typical convention attendee who has been out having a good time half the night. Throwing on a windbreaker and cursing her boots, she walks quickly to the hotel beneath the dim auras of streetlights. This Radisson is self-service, as Lucy calls hotels where she carries her own bags, uses her magnetized room key to let herself into the gym and fills her own ice bucket, and where the housekeepers are shocked when left a tip. There is no doorman or bellman at this hour, only a young woman reading a Polish magazine behind the front desk. Lucy stays outside in the dark, glancing around, making certain no one suddenly walks up and sees her. In that unlikely event, she will dig inside the small leather satchel looped over her shoulder, pretending to look for her room key. She waits restlessly for 10 minutes before the bored, weary desk clerk gets up and walks off, perhaps to the ladies' room, perhaps to find coffee. Lucy strolls across the lobby and disappears inside the elevator, pushing the button for the 5th floor. Rudy is in room 511. It is not his room. He got inside the hotel very much the same way Lucy did, only he got a good break, got to walk in with a crowd of businessmen returning from dinner. Fortunately, he was smart enough to wear a suit and tie. Rudy is an odd breed. Former HRT comrades envied his beautiful muscular body and accused him of taking steroids, which he has never touched. Lucy would know, because Rudy may have his flaws, but he is so honest and sincere that she sometimes calls him girlfriend. She knows every detail of his diet, vitamin and protein supplements and grueling workout routines, and his favorite magazines and television shows. She can't remember the last time he read a book. She also understands why he sexually assaulted her in the tire house, and if anything, feels bad that she broke his nose.
"I thought you were hot for me, too. I swear," he explained with the most pitiful expression on his face.
I guess I got all excited rolling around between tires and shooting, and you were right there with me, with cartridge cases pinging everywhere, both of us dirty and sooty, and you looked so good I couldn't stand it. So I asked you that question, when I shouldn't have, and then you said you wanted sex whenever you could get it. I thought you meant with me.
Right that minute? Lucy said. You really thought that?
Yeah, that you were hot and bothered too.
Now and then you should watch something besides action movies, Lucy replied. Walt Disney, maybe? They had this conversation inside her room at the FBI Academy, both of them sitting on her bed because she was not afraid of Rudy and never has been. He was the one with stitches below his lip and a broken nose that required the skills of a plastic surgeon.
Besides, and I know this may sound like bullshit to you, Lucy, but I'd had it with what the other guys were saying. Maybe I wanted to prove something, prove you weren't what they've been saying.
I get it. If we had sex, then you could go back and tell them all about it.
No, I didn't mean it like that. I wouldn't have told them anything. It's none of their business.
Let me sort through this. Having sex in the tire house would have proven to the other guys that I'm into guys, even though they wouldn't have known about our having sex in the tire house because you're too honorable to kiss and tell.
Ah, fuck.
Rudy stared dejectedly at the floor.
I'm not saying it right. I wouldn't have told them a thing, but next time they badmouthed you, accused you of being gay or frigid or whatever, I could have given them a look. Done something to indicate they didn't know what they were talking about.
I appreciate that your intention was my welfare as you tried to rip off my clothes and rape me, Lucy replied.
I wasn't trying to rape you. For Christ's sake, don't use a word like that. I thought you were turned on, too. Shit, Lucy, what do you want me to do?
Never try a stunt like that again. Or next time I'll break more than your nose.
Fine. I won't ever do anything again unless you start it. Or change your mind.
He resigned from the bureau and eventually came to work for her at the last precinct. Rudy is a perplexing mix. In some ways, he is the big, handsome dope incapable of making a commitment to any woman he has ever claimed to desperately love, and his choices, as far as Lucy knows, demonstrate appallingly bad judgment. But as a crime fighter, he is as meticulous and skillful as he is as a helicopter pilot. Rudy isn't selfish or narcissistic. He rarely drinks, and he never touches drugs, not even aspirin.
One good thing about it, Rudy looked up at Lucy as they sat on her bed. When the plastic surgeon was fixing my nose, he went ahead and shaved that little bump off it.
He gently touched the splint on the bridge of his nose.
He says I'll have a perfect Roman nose. That's what he called it, a Roman nose.
He paused, slightly perplexed.
What exactly is a Roman nose?
37. Lucy knocks on the door of room 511. It has a do not disturb sign hanging on the knob, and the TV is loud inside, hoofs pounding, guns firing. It sounds like Rudy is watching a western, but what he's watching is Rocco.
Yeah?
After a pause, Rudy's voice sounds from inside. Down and secure. She uses helicopter talk and scans the hallway as she pulls latex gloves out of a pocket and works her hands into them. The door opens wide enough for her to slip through, and she closes it behind her. Rudy is also wearing surgical gloves and turns the lock and deadbolt. Lucy takes off her windbreaker and stares hard at Rocco Caggiano, at his flabby, fat body and his bloodshot eyes. She takes in every detail of the room. Draped over a chair is his black cashmere overcoat, and in a corner on the carpet are a plastic tray and an empty bottle of champagne, next to a stainless steel ice bucket filled with water. It would have taken hours for the ice to completely melt. The bed is king size, and directly across from it, in front of a window with the drapes drawn, are a small glass table and two chairs. On the carpet are several British newspapers. He's recently been in England, maybe. But Rocco has never bothered to learn a second language. The papers could have come from anywhere along his route here. Parked between the table and the bed is a room service cart with nothing on it but four stainless steel plate covers. Lucy can't help but think of Rocco's estranged father, Pete Marino,
as she eyes a gnawed T-bone, the shredded skin of a baked potato, a plate with one pat of butter left, melted, an empty bread basket, and a glass goblet filled with wilted lettuce, cocktail sauce, wedges of lemon and shrimp tails. He so completely devoured a slice of chocolate cake, nothing is left but smears made with Rocco's fingers.
"I gotta go.
Be my guest."
She hurries into the bathroom. The stench is horrible.
"He's sober?"
Lucy asks Rudy when she returns.
"Sober enough.
Must be in the genes."
"What?"
"The way father and son take care of themselves," she says. "But that's all he and Marino have in common."
This to Rocco.
"Drop by Szczecin to check on a few spare firearms. Maybe some ammunition, explosives, electronics, perfumes, and designer clothing. How many phony bills of lading are in your briefcase?"
Rocco glares at her, his attention dropping to her cleavage.
"Keep your goddamn eyes to yourself," Lucy snaps, having forgotten about her appearance.
She buttons up and resumes her interrogation.
"Probably thousands of them floating around somewhere, right, Rocco?"
He says nothing. Lucy notices vomit on the carpet between his black crocodile loafers.
"About time you gagged on your own shit, Rocco."
She sits on the edge of the bed.
"That a pickle up your sleeve, or you just happy to see me?" Rudy says to Lucy without a smile, without taking his eyes off Rocco.
Lucy remembers the tactical baton up the sleeve of her linen blouse, slips it out, and sets it on the bedside table. It is warm in the room. She glances at the thermostat, verifying that Rudy turned up the heat to 74 degrees. Any higher than that could arouse suspicion. Blowing heat moves the drapes drawn across the window on the other side of the room. The window is large and faces the front of the hotel. Rocco stares at the pistol, his eyes filling with tears.
"My, my," Lucy remarks. "You're quite a crybaby for someone so mean and tough. And by the way, your father doesn't cry."
She looks at Rudy.
"You ever seen Marino cry?"
"Nope."
"You ever seen him shit in his pants?"
"Nope."
"Did you know that Rocco here had plans to put a bullet in Marino's head on his fishing trip? You know, the one he always takes to Bugs Lake?"
Lucy doesn't comment. A flush creeps up her neck. Hopefully Marino will never know that she and Rudy came here and probably saved his life. Rocco won't be shooting anyone ever again.
"You could have killed your father years ago. Why this August?" Lucy asks him.
She knows when Marino takes his annual fishing trip. Rocco shrugs.
"Instructions?
From whom?"
"My former client. He has scores to settle."
"Jean-Baptiste," Lucy says. "So the two of you have remained close. That's touching, because he's the reason you're about to die."
"I don't believe you," Rocco exclaims. "He'd never... He needs me."
"For what?" Rudy asks.
"Outside work," Rocco replies. "I'm still his attorney. He can send me anything he wants, contact me any time he wants."
"What does he send you?" Rudy asks.
"Anything. All he's got to do is mark it legal mail and no one can open it. So if he wants letters or shit sent to somebody who obviously ain't a lawyer, he sends it through me."
"The letter I got from him that ratted you out, Rocco, did he send it through you?" Lucy asks.
"No. He's never sent me a letter with your name on it. I never open them. Too risky. If he ever found out..."
He pauses, his eyes glassy.
"I don't believe he sent you a letter."
"We're here, aren't we?" Rudy says. "So how did that happen if Sean Dunn didn't send a letter and tell us everything we need to know?"
Rocco has no answer.
"Why would he want you to kill your father?"
Lucy isn't about to forget that subject.
"Especially now. What scores to settle?"
"Maybe Jean-Baptiste don't like him. I guess you could consider it a parting shot."
Rocco briefly looks smug.
"Mind if I see that for a minute?"
Lucy holds out her hand for Rudy's pistol. He drops out the magazine and clears the round from the chamber. The cartridge bounces on the bed. Lucy picks it up and Rudy gives her the Colt. She walks close to Rocco and pushes the loose cartridge into the magazine with her thumb.
"Your father taught me how to drive," she tells Rocco in a conversational tone. "You ever seen those huge pickup trucks of his? Well, that's what I learned on when I was so little I had to sit on a pillow, even with the seat raised."
She racks back the slide and aims the pistol between his eyes. He taught me how to shoot, too. She squeezes the trigger. Click. Rocco jumps violently. Oops. Lucy smacks the magazine back inside the handle. Forgot it wasn't loaded. Get up, Rocco.
You're cops.
His voice trembles in fear and disbelief.
Cops don't kill people. They don't do this.
I'm not a cop, Rudy says to Lucy.
Are you a cop?
No, I'm not a cop. I don't see a single cop in this room, do you?
Some CIA paramilitary operatives. But they sent you into Iraq, didn't they? To take out Saddam Hussein. I know what people like you do.
Never been to Iraq, have you? Lucy says to Rudy.
Not recently.
38. Another Western is playing on the TV. Mouths move out of sync as two cowboys dismount their horses, voices dubbed in Polish.
One last chance, Rudy says to Rocco. Where's Jay Talley? Don't lie. I promise I'll know.
He took a statement analysis course at the FBI Academy, Lucy says drolly, was the star of the class.
Rocco slowly shakes his head. It is apparent by now that if he knew, he would tell them. He is a self-serving, sniveling coward, and right now he is more afraid of them than he is of Jay Talley.
Here's the deal. We're not going to kill you, Rocco.
Lucy tosses the pistol back to Rudy.
You're going to commit suicide.
No.
He shakes as if he has Parkinson's disease.
Your history, Rocco, Rudy says. A fugitive. A red notice. You can't go anywhere anyway. You'll be grabbed. If you're lucky, you'll end up in prison, probably in Sicily, and I hear that's not a holiday. But you know better. The Shandons will take you out instantly. And perhaps not as humanely as you can end your own miserable, stinking life right now.
Lucy goes to the bed and digs an envelope out of her shoulder bag's back pocket. Inside it is a folded sheet of paper. She opens it. Here. She offers it to Rocco. He makes no effort to touch it. Take it. A hard copy of your red notice, hot off the press. You must be curious.
Rocco doesn't respond.
Even his eyeballs seem to be shaking. Take it, Lucy tells him. Rocco does. The red notice shakes violently in his hands as he leaves his fingerprints on the paper, a detail he probably isn't thinking about. Now, read it out loud. I think it's very important you see what it says, because I'm confident you'll decide you have no choice but to kill yourself right here in this lovely hotel room, Lucy says. The single page has Interpol's crest in the upper right corner, of course in bright red. Prominently displayed is Rocco's photograph, easily acquired. Egotist that he is, he has never ducked the camera when he's represented criminals in scandalous trials. The picture on the red notice is recent and a very good likeness. Read out loud, Lucy orders him again. Story time, Rocco.
Identity particulars.
His voice wavers, and he continues to clear his throat.
Present family name, Rocco Caggiano. Name at birth, Peter Rocco Marino, Jr.
He pauses at this, and tears brighten his eyes. He bites his lower lip, then continues reading on and on all about himself. When he gets to the judicial information and reads that he is wanted for the murders of the Sicilian and French journalists, he rolls his eyes toward the ceiling.
Jesus, he mutters, taking a deep breath.
That's right, Lucy says. Arrest warrant number 7260 for poor Mr. Guarino, arrest warrant number 7261 for poor Monsieur Lafleur. Issued April 24th, 2003, 2 days ago.
Jesus fucking Christ.
Your faithful client, Jean-Baptiste, Lucy reminds him.
The bastard, Rocco mutters, after all I did for the ugly piece of shit.
It's over, Rocco, Rudy says. He drops the red notice on top of the table. I understand the Shandons can be pretty creative, Lucy says. Torture. Remember how much Jay Talley liked to string people up with rope and eye bolts and burn them with heat guns? Burn them until their skin was charred black, while they were alive and conscious. Remember how he tried to do that to my aunt while his fucking accomplice Bev Kiffin tried to blow me away with a shotgun? Rocco stares off. She steps closer to him, the thought of what almost happened to her aunt tempting her to whip open her tactical baton and beat Rocco to death. She glances at it on the bedside table, knows better. "Drowning is another pet choice," she goes on. Rocco jerks at this.
"No,"
he begs. "Remember Jean-Baptiste's cousin Thomas? Drowned. Not a nice way to die." She gives Rudy a look. He carefully wipes off the colt with a corner of the bedsheet as an extra precaution, his face hard, his eyes gleaming with a detachment and determination that makes it possible for him to block out the sudden wave of empathy he feels for Rocco, no matter how unworthy of life he is. Rudy glances at Lucy, and briefly their eyes touch like two sparks. Sweat rolls down Lucy's face, wisps of hair plastered to her temples. She is pale, and Rudy knows that each of her attempts at dry humor and harshness are forced as she plays the most terrible role of her life. He pulls back the slide, chambering around, and approaches Rocco.
"Right-handed, you agree, partner?" Rudy calmly says to Lucy.
"I agree."
She doesn't take her eyes off Rocco. Her hands have begun to shake, and she wills herself to think of Jay Talley and his evil paramour, Bev Kiffin. Images. Lucy envisions the grief on her aunt's face as she scattered what she believed were Benton Wesley's ashes over the water. Lucy's brain seems to slide inside her skull. She has never been seasick. It must feel something like this.
"Your choice," she says to Rocco. "I mean it. You can die now and feel no pain, no torture, no burns, no drowning. The red notice is found right where you dropped it. Your suicide completely understandable. Or you can walk out of here, never knowing when you'll breathe your last breath and what nightmare you'll suffer when the Shandans get you, and they will." He nods. "Of course they will. It is a given."
"Put out your right hand," Rudy tells Rocco.
Rocco rolls his eyes toward the ceiling again.
"See? I'm holding the gun. I'm going to help you," Rudy goes on, lightly, indifferently, as sweat drips on the carpet.
"Make sure the barrel is pointed up," Lucy says, thinking of the decapitated Nazi's head.
"Come on, Rocco, do what I say. It won't hurt. You won't even know it."
Rudy touches the barrel against Rocco's right temple. "Up," Lucy reminds him again.
"Your hand goes around the grips, and my hand goes around yours."
Rocco closes his eyes, and his hand jumps up and down. He closes his pudgy short fingers around the grips, and Rudy's big strong hand immediately clamps over his.
"I have to help you because you can't hold the gun still," Rudy tells him. "You don't shoot straight, and that could be ugly. And I can't let you hold the gun all by yourself, now can I? That would make me stupid."
Rudy's voice is gentle now.
"See, that's not so hard. Now press the barrel tight against your head."
Rocco gags, his chest heaving. He begins to hyperventilate. "Point it up," Lucy says it one more time, fixated on the decapitated Nazi's head, trying not to see Rocco's head. He sways in his chair, grabbing shallow breaths, his face livid, his eyes squeezed shut. Rudy's gloved finger pulls the trigger. The gun fires in a loud pop. Rocco and his chair fall backward. His head lands on the British newspapers strewn over the carpet, his face turned toward the window. Blood gushing out of his head sounds like running water. Gun smoke turns the air acrid. Rudy squats to tuck Rocco's limp right arm and the pistol under his chest. Any prints or partial prints recovered on the blue steel Colt will be Rocco's. Lucy opens a window a crack, no more than 3 inches, and yanks off her gloves as Rudy presses 2 fingers against Rocco Caggiano's carotid artery. His pulse beats faintly and stops. Rudy nods at Lucy and stands up. He digs inside a pocket of his jacket and pulls out a German mustard jar. Holes have been punched in the lid, and blowflies crawl along the inside of the glass, feeding on what is left of the rotting meat that yesterday baited them into captivity at a dumpster crammed with garbage behind a Polish restaurant. He opens the jar and shakes it. Several dozen flies lethargically lift off, buzzing to lamps and bouncing against illuminated shades.
Sensing pheromones and the plume of an open wound, they greedily droned straight to Rocco's motionless body. Blowflies, the most common of carrion-feeding insects, alight on his bloody face. Several disappear inside his mouth. 39. It is only 8 p.m. in Boston. Pete Marino sits at the U.S. Air Gate eating chocolate-dipped pretzels and listening to another apologetic announcement that promises his flight will depart after another minor delay of only 2 hours and 10 minutes. This is after an earlier delay that has already held him hostage in Logan Airport for 1 hour and 25 minutes beyond his scheduled departure. "Shit!" he exclaims, not caring who hears him. "I could have walked by now." Rarely does he have plenty of time to ponder his life, and he thinks of Benton and diverts his misery and rage by focusing on Benton's physical conditioning and hard, manly body. He looks even better than he used to, Marino depressingly decides. How can that be possible after 6 years of what amounts to solitary confinement? Marino can't comprehend it. He starts on a brownie from the basket of delicious desserts of Gainesville that he happened upon in the airport gift shop, and wonders what it would be like if he quit working for Lucy, just gave up going after dirtbags. They're cockroaches. Squash one and five others take its place. Maybe Marino should go fishing. Maybe become a professional bowler. He almost had a perfect score once. Find him a nice woman and build a cabin in the woods. Once, very long ago, Marino was admired too, and the mirror did not hate him. Women and men, he supposes, with confusion and disgust, stare at Benton and lust for him. Marino is certain of this. They can't resist him when added to his good looks are his brain and his big-shot FBI status, or more accurately, former FBI status. Marino pushes back strings of gray hair and wakes himself up to the fact that people don't meet Benton anymore and know his real name or admire his former FBI career. He is supposed to be dead or Tom or nobody. That Scarpetta could miss Benton so much causes Marino a sick pain somewhere around his heart and topples him into deeper despair. He hurts deeply for her. He hurts deeply for himself. If he died, she would grieve, but not forever. She has never been in love with him, never will be, and doesn't want his fat, hairy body in her bed. Marino wanders into another gift shop and snatches a fitness magazine off a pile on the floor, an action as foreign to him as Hebrew. Men's Workout has a handsome young man on the cover who looks as if he's cut of smooth stone. He must have shaved his entire body except for his head and polished his tanned skin with oil. Marino returns to a nearby sports bar, orders another Budweiser on tap, finds his same table, brushes off pizza crumbs, and sets down the magazine, somewhat afraid of opening it. He finally musters the nerve to pick it up, and its slick cover sticks to the table.
"Hey!" Marino calls to the bartender. "Anyone ever wipe off a table in this joint?"
Everyone in the bar stares at Marino.
"I just paid $3.50 for this watered-down beer, and the table's so disgusting, my magazine's sticking to it."
Everyone in the bar stares at Marino's magazine. Several young men nudge one another and smile. The annoyed bartender, who would have to be an octopus to keep up with orders, tosses a wet bar towel to Marino. He wipes off his table and tosses it back, almost hitting an old woman in the head. She sips her white wine, oblivious. Marino starts flipping through his magazine. Maybe it isn't too late to reclaim his masculine plumage, to have muscles he can flex like a peacock fanning its tail. As a boy in New Jersey, he made himself strong from chin-ups, push-ups, and maniacal repetitions with free weights he constructed from cinder blocks and mop or broom handles. He lifted the rear ends of cars to work on his back and biceps, clutched a laundry bag filled with bricks while doing squats or running up and down stairs. He boxed with laundry drying on the clothesline, always on windy days when the clothes and linens fought back.
"Peter Rocco, you stop fighting with the laundry. You knock it in the dirt and you get to wash it."
His mother was a meshed figure behind the screen door, hands on her hips, trying to sound severe as her son's savage right hook yanked one of his father's wet undershirts from wooden clothespins and sent it sailing into a nearby bush. As Marino got older, he wrapped his fists in layers of rags and threw wicked punches at an old mattress he kept in the crawl space beneath the house. If it was possible to kill a mattress, this one died 1,000 times, propped up against the porch, its ticking finally ripping and its dry-rotted foam rubber disintegrating with each blow. Marino scavenged neighborhood trash piles for discarded mattresses, and he battled his stained, obtuse opponents as if he hated them for some unforgivable sin they had committed against him.
"Who are you trying to kill, honey?"
his mother asked him one afternoon when he was dripping with sweat and wobbly from exhaustion and flinging open the refrigerator door for the ice water his mother always kept there.
"Don't drink out of the jug. How many times I gotta tell you? You know what germs are? They're little ugly bugs crawling out of your mouth right into the jug. Don't matter if you can't see 'em. Doesn't make them any less real, and those very germs are what gives you and everyone else the flu and polio, and you end up in an iron lung, and—"
"Dad drinks out of the jug."
"Well?"
"Well, what, Mom?"
"He's the man of the house."
"Well, ain't that something? Guess he ain't got little ugly bugs crawling out of him like everybody else since he's the man of the house. Guess he don't give a rat's ass who ends up in an iron lung."
"Who are you fighting out there when you beat up the mattress? Fight, fight, fight. You're always fighting."
Marino buys another beer and consoles himself with the thought that the male models in the workout magazine are not fighters because they have the flexibility of a rock. They don't dance on their feet, boxing. They don't do anything but lift iron and pose for photographers and poison themselves with steroids. Still, Marino wouldn't mind having a stomach that looks like moguls in a ski run, and what he wouldn't give for his hair to come home to his head instead of continuing its relentless migration to other parts of his body. He smokes and drinks to the noise of a basketball dribbling, shoes squeaking, and crowds yelling on the big screen TV. Loudly flipping through a few more pages of his magazine, he begins to notice advertisements for aphrodisiacs, performance enhancements, and invitations to skin parties and strip volleyball. When he reaches a centerfold of hairless hunks wearing G-strings and fishnet bikini briefs, he slaps the magazine shut. A businessman sitting one table over gets up and moves to the other end of the bar. Marino takes his time finishing his beer and gets up and stretches and yawns. People in the bar watch him as he makes his way toward the businessman and drops the magazine on top of his Wall Street Journal.
"Call me,"
Marino says with a wink as he saunters out of the bar.
This book is continued on Disc 5.